Well, certainly an amazing passage there from the book of Ezekiel, which we're continuing to have a look at over the next few weeks. Please have that open. It's on page 820, and we'll be considering that passage this morning. Let me lead us in prayer as we do that. Father, thank you for this word to us, and though it is obviously complex and strange and foreign to us, we pray that you'd give us ears to hear and minds to understand and hearts and wills to obey. We ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen. Have you ever had the experience of seeing a summer storm roll in from the horizon with its huge sort of, you know, cumulonimbus clouds moving swiftly and erupting and foaming with lightning in and around it? On the 31st of July in 593 BC, a man called Ezekiel saw such a sight on the horizon, a windstorm coming in from the distance. He tells us in his book in verse 4, "I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north." There's nothing surprising here. The prevailing breezes are from the northwest at that time of year in Babylon. But as we heard from our story, this is no ordinary storm. The cloud is enormous. It has fire, perhaps lightning, flashing back and forth. And instead of being dark, it has a kind of brightness around it. And the heart of it glows like a furnace. And as the windstorm comes near, Ezekiel sees more and more detail. And the first thing he sees is these humanoid creatures in the midst of the fiery cloud. But they certainly aren't human. Have a look at verse 5. "And in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight. Their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved." That's Ezekiel's summary of them, but he gives us more details. In verse 10, he tells us their faces looked like this. Each one of them had the face of a man, and on the right-hand side, the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Also, each had the face of an eagle. It's relatively easy at one level to create a picture in your head of what Ezekiel's looking at, but what does that strange picture mean? I said last week that as we read the book of Ezekiel, we need to be like interested tourists, taking this time to understand this foreign world that Ezekiel's speaking to. And in Ezekiel's world, they would have understood the significance of this. Rabbis would later write, four kinds of proud beings were created in the world. The proudest of all, man; of birds, the eagle; of domestic animals, the bull; of wild animals, the lion. Ezekiel's saying this is the greatest creature ever made. The living beings here are wise as humans, swift and mobile as eagles, valuable and life-giving as cattle, and majestic and fierce as lions. All these four creatures with four faces and four wings, why all the fours? Most likely it represents the compass bearings, the four winds, and they move with the wind. That word there can be translated wind or spirit. They're moving in any direction. They don't have to turn because of their four faces. They're always facing forward. Ezekiel is conveying these as the greatest of the creatures that exist. They can stand with bronze bull's legs. They can fly with wings to spare. And he sees them zooming in this fiery storm while their bodies themselves burn and glow. Ezekiel really grapples to describe this. Look at this, verse 13. "The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of a fire, or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it." What would you do if you saw one of these creatures, let alone four of them? I mean, the temptation might be to turn and run away, and yet where can you hide from such beauty and power and speed and intelligence? And yet Ezekiel's story isn't finished yet. Each of these creatures has a wheel next to them. He tells us that in 15 to 21. These two are glorious. They sparkle like a yellow-green gem. They're covered with eyes, which I take it is like, you know, like they're covered with little gemstones all around them. And because of the wheels intersecting the wheels, they don't need to turn as they move with these living creatures that change direction. And these wheels, not only that, they have a kind of life within them. The spirit of the living creatures, or perhaps more generally, the spirit of life is in them, driving them on. Again, there is this glorious picture of movement, and these can move not only back and forth and side to side, but up and down. Why are there wheels here with these four living creatures? Well, look at verse 22. Spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse, sparkling like ice and awesome. There is a kind of platform set up on top of the wheels and on top of the creatures. And this is some kind of cosmic chariot, isn't it? It rides on the wings of the storm. It's held aloft by these glorious creatures and these high and awesome wheels. This platform shows us that this is a chariot, and the glory of the creatures and the wheels and the storm, they're only servants. They sit below this expanse, below this platform, to drive it around, to move it around. And now for the first time, Ezekiel begins to describe not just what he's seeing, but what he hears as well. Look at verse 23. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out one towards another, and each had two wings covering its body. When the living creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings, like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. Again, Ezekiel is confronted by something incredible and he struggles to describe it. It sounds like a waterfall or like the thundering of God from the sky or like the commotion of an army camp. But then he looks back up onto the platform and he sees what rides atop this almighty chariot with its terrific entourage. First, he sees a throne cut from lapis lazuli. That's what they called sapphire back then. A deep ultramarine stone shooting up from the expanse. And high up on the throne, there is another figure. Let's read that, verse 26. Above the expanse, over their heads, was what looked like a throne of sapphire. And high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw the form of what appeared to be above his waist up, looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And that from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light shone, so brilliant light surrounded him, like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. So was the radiance around him. Ezekiel can see it looks like a human being, but this is certainly no ordinary man. From the waist up, he's this glowing metal, this bright amber, and his lower body is just this fiery glow. And I take it this is the source of the glow that Ezekiel saw out in the distance when he saw that cloud coming in. All around is lit up, and Ezekiel tells us it's not just brilliant white. No, it's every color of the rainbow. The prophet is struggling to describe this once again. All through here, he piles up words of this description as like and as, or of the appearance of this. He can't quite find the right words. It's like this. Oh, no, maybe it's more like that. Or maybe it's more like this. All the way along, he's been doing this. And as Ezekiel sees this vision, he somehow knows what he's looking at. How does he know? And what would his earliest readers make of the description so far? Well, we know from the older biblical stories of Moses and Elijah and Isaiah of their encounters with God. And in the ancient Near Eastern world, we know there are scenes of animals bearing deities in human form. And we know there were ancient seals depicting storm gods riding in on the clouds. Ezekiel's vision moves beyond all those visions, though. It beats them out for power and glory and mobility. And Ezekiel's readers would have been anywhere near surprised to see Ezekiel's conclusion. And if they too were confronted by such a thing, they would have reacted in the same way. Ezekiel says, "This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. When I saw it, I fell face down." The Lord, the God of Israel, Yahweh, has appeared in this vision to Ezekiel. But take note of how Ezekiel writes it. He says it's the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Having seen this God is far away and above these mighty creatures, Ezekiel will not conclude that this vision comes anywhere near close to completely capturing all of the glory of God, let alone God himself. And yet at the same time, it is truly God he's dealing with. He rides on the storm. Even today, we have all of this modern techniques and systems for predicting the weather and for building homes that can withstand it. And yet we know the power and ferocity of storms. I remember those images from a few months ago from both Perth and from around Sydney of the storms that just battered the coast, or just a couple of weeks ago down in Tasmania. We know the ferocity of storms, and yet what is this incredibly untamable phenomenon to us? Well, that's like God's car, and he just gets in and starts it up and drives it around. The God above all creaturely power comes down and meets with Ezekiel and speaks with him. And that's how this passage finishes. "And I heard the voice of one speaking." Imagine, if you will, Hamlet trying to understand Shakespeare. He can't. Although everything around him is filled with Shakespeare, even he himself, he can't go anywhere to find Shakespeare. Hamlet can never meet Shakespeare unless Shakespeare writes himself into the play. Similarly, people, we cannot meet with God unless he steps into our world and writes himself into history. And in Ezekiel's book, that's what happened. The divine steps into the mundane. God put himself before Ezekiel. He revealed himself to him. He showed him his plans and his purposes for what had happened and what will happen. And there are three points that drive implications from this passage. And they're both important for Ezekiel's world and for our world. They're important for Ezekiel's audience and for us here in Dongara reading this 2,500 years later. Here's the first point that drives implications. This right here is the powerful, holy, and supreme God. It's important for the exiles to hear this loud and clear. I mean, their exile had been a great defeat and a source of shame for God's people. But clearly it hasn't diminished their God's power in any way. Everything about this proclaims that the Lord is glorious. He's above and beyond all creaturely power, and he alone is on the throne, on the expanse, carried by these glorious creatures. As I said before, Ezekiel's vision picks up on and modifies themes that would have been familiar to the exiles. You might remember the pillar of cloud and fire that led the people out of Egypt. their interaction with God and Moses on Mount Sinai, the descending glory cloud on the tabernacle and later on the temple in Jerusalem. Here is the same God with the same power. And significantly for the exiles, this means that everything that's happened and everything that will happen in Jerusalem is still under God's control. Their exile could not have in any way taken this powerful God by surprise. Any disruption of the temple, even if it damages his reputation in the world, it cannot actually threaten the holiness and the supremacy of the one who sits on the throne above these burning creatures. And this is going to become much more significant later in the book, as Ezekiel will see God's chariot bring judgment on Jerusalem. The coals of the fires in this storm cloud will be spread out over Jerusalem in judgment. But this must also mean that these exiles have no excuse for ignoring their God. Now, during the recent coup attempt in Turkey, the president made sure that as soon as possible, people saw him on TV. People saw that he was still in control. The aim would have been to get as many pictures of him standing in front of groups of soldiers, standing in front of parliament to show he was still in control. That's the kind of thing this message gives to the exiles. God hasn't lost. God doesn't, he hasn't ceased to exist. He wasn't anywhere near being toppled by what's taken place. And if God is still on the throne, then he must be obeyed. He must be taken seriously. And these words that have been spoken by God both before Ezekiel's time and in this book, they need to be heard. But also this picture needs to become also, I think, a source of comfort for the Israelites. Because the God who chose their father Abraham, the God who saved them from Egypt, that same God, he's still the God of all. Here is the powerful, holy, and supreme God. It's important for them and it's important for us. See, this is the same God we deal with. And I wonder, does this match your picture of God? I mean, so sure, we probably don't think of God in terms of being carried around by living creatures with four faces. That may not be our normal way of thinking about it. But do we think of God as being above and beyond even the most powerful things in our universe? Even the most powerful things imaginable? I think it's tempting to think of God just being, you know, a little bit or even quite a bit, he's sort of just better than us, more powerful than us, bigger than us. And even if we're overestimating our power, which, you know, we probably are, it's easy to see from this vision that we regularly underestimate the power and the glory of God. He's not just a little bit bigger than us. He is almighty. It's so easy to think of God as just a little bigger than us, but this shows us he is much bigger than us. And this should also cause us to take God's word seriously. Will we not hear his words that this God has spoken? And of course, it should be a source of comfort for us because there's nothing that can threaten the position of God. He remains in control of his world. Secondly, here is the God who moves through the earth. This mobility in this vision is really significant, and it's important for the exiles to understand this, that God was not confined to the temple or Jerusalem or to the land of Canaan. No, he's out here with his people. You can't escape the sense of movement in this passage, the storm, the feet, the wings, the wheels, and perhaps most importantly, the spirit, the wind. God is not static. In the ancient Near Eastern world, people thought there were local deities for each place. Each territory had its own god. And the land of Babylon was the territory of the god Marduk. But even as Babylon invaded and will invade again Judah and Jerusalem, the Lord Yahweh, in a sense here, invades Babylon. He's not just on the throne in Jerusalem. He's in control of whatever happens, wherever it happens. And this means that far from being beyond the reach of the concern of Yahweh, the exiles, the people Ezekiel was writing to who've lost their homes, they can know that God is right there with them and in control wherever they go. And this too is important for us. We should not think of God as being confined. We should not think that we can run from him or get away from him, because there's nowhere and no one and no thing that is off limits. And while I think we get that in a global sense, I suspect that we easily forget it when it comes to sort of aspects of our lives. It may be deliberate that we don't want God to step in and change the way that we do things. We want to hold on to our anger or our grievances or our gossiping. But it may be more by default that we just really don't consult God. We don't think about the things that he wants us to be doing. We don't pray about things because we forget or we're just not in the habit of doing. God clearly is concerned by everything, everywhere. That's why he rides on this chariot on the storm. We live in a relatively remote part of the world, but God is here. And he wants to bring his rule to this part of the world, into our lives and into the lives of our wider community. It's important for us to hear this. And thirdly, this is the God who comes and speaks. This is the God who comes and speaks. And it's important for the exiles to know this because he's not abandoned his people. No, he comes near, and not just comes near, but speaks to them. I'm not going to expand on this point because we're going to see his words next week especially. We're going to see the words to the prophet in the commissioning of Ezekiel, who's going to go and bring the words to the people. The point of this passage, though, it orients the reader at the start of this book. I've got to read on. I've got to see what this mighty and mobile God is going to say. This is the God who comes and speaks. And we need to know this too, because we know the God who comes and speaks. The Christian God is the God who speaks. But how has God spoken to us? Now, people long to have a kind of spiritual experience. People in our world want a spiritual revelation, and they'll seek it in all kinds of different ways, through all kinds of different means, to know that there is something out there beyond our world speaking to us, guiding us, shaping us, growing us as people. And they'll look for all kinds of ways to do that. People, I think, would probably want to see something like Ezekiel saw. They'd like to know that God is there and he is in control and he moves through the earth and he speaks. And we certainly should treasure Ezekiel's testimony as a window into God's power and glory. But Christians, we've got something so much better and bigger and more important even than this. Ezekiel really did see a manifestation of God, but by his own admission, even in the incredible things he saw, it was only the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. Ezekiel's vision and the words that he has here are written for us, even if they're not directly to us. But what did the other reading that we read say? That one from the book of Hebrews. If you'd like to open it, turn over to page 1184. It says this: in the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. We've certainly seen one of those ways this morning. Verse 2, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. In Ezekiel's vision, God's majesty and power are completely evident. The God who came near to Ezekiel, though, he's come so much more nearer to us. Not just in a vision to a prophet, but into humanity, into history with humility, even to death on the cross. And it's tempting to think that because he came so much more accessibly, because Jesus was born into our world in humility without strength, giving up his power even to death on the cross, it's tempting to think that somehow he's less than the picture of glory and might that Ezekiel saw. But though he became human, he didn't seek to be God. Hebrews tells us he is the radiance of God's glory. He is the exact representation of God's being, and everything exists and continues to exist because of his word, because of his command. And though he reserved to some extent that power and supremacy to make purification for sins, Jesus now sits at the right hand of God. This one who is the exact representation of God's being is not just a vision of a human. No, he remains a real, actual human forevermore. Ezekiel's vision of the mighty and moving God needs to be taken seriously, and it brought comfort. The point this drives home, I think, for Ezekiel's readers is that they need to read the words. They need to listen to the one who speaks. How much more do we need to hear the gospel of Jesus? That's where the writer of the Hebrews concludes. He goes to the start of chapter 2. He speaks about the supremacy of Christ all through chapter 1. And then he says this, chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. For if the message spoken by angels was binding, that means spoken by angels, revealed by angels, like this vision Ezekiel saw, if that message was binding and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation? In Jesus, there is this great salvation, this great revelation. But we must not ignore it. We must listen and pay attention to the mighty and moving God who spoke to Ezekiel and has spoken to us through his Son.